I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of December. Everywhere you turn, there is another story about Pope Francis, so we thought that it was time to ask why. As you well know, he was the Time Man of the Year. People all over the world, Catholics and non-Catholics, are fascinated by this Pope. He's adopted a softer tone toward gay people. He has gotten rid of, at least for himself, and he's starting to do this for others, some of the features, lavish features of the papal lifestyle. He's washed the feet of convicts. He's called for greater efforts to lift up the world's poor. He recently talked about economic inequality in a very definitive way. And he is a man who has examined himself and his own conscience and called himself for when he has come up short. So he is refreshingly honest about who he is. This hour, our guest is Reverend James Martin. He's a Jesuit priest. He's editor at large of America, the National Catholic Magazine, author of all kinds of books, including Between Heaven and Mirth, Why Joy, Humor, and Laughter Are at the Heart of the Spiritual Life. He's written the Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, Searching for God at Ground Zero, In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. And that references Father Martin's 6 years working in corporate finance before he entered the Society of Jesus in 1988. He's worked at a hospital for the seriously ill in Cambridge, a hospice in Kingston, Jamaica, a school for poor boys in New York City, the Jesuit Refugee Service East Africa, helping East African refugees start small businesses. He's been a chaplain at a Boston prison. And he's also appeared on The Colbert Report, NPR, every major TV and radio network. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour, which I'm sure is going to be a very interesting one. Why has the Pope become the subject of fascination and attention all over the world when he's only been Pope since March? It's a very short period of time. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Father James Martin, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, really nice to have you here. You wrote a very interesting piece for the Jesuit Journals Worldwide, the exclusive interview with Pope Francis, which you looked at very carefully and found some things he said that were relatively new and some that you thought were very important. And you start with the way the Pope has done an examination of himself, and has been critical of himself at times, hasn't he?
He has. In that interview, which was done by a Jesuit named Antonio Spadaro in Italy for all the 16 Jesuit journals across the world, was very revealing. He basically says, I'm a sinner. That's how he identifies himself. And then he says, when I was a Jesuit provincial, i.e. regional superior, I made rash and authoritarian decisions. So it's not like he's saying I'm a sinner in general. He points out where he sinned and where he thinks he failed.
Which all Christians should do, all Christians are called to do?
Oh, absolutely. That's just part of the Christian worldview and Christian practice. It's specifically Jesuit. There's something called the examination of conscience that we do. But I think what struck me is that most leaders, most people would say something vague like, oh, mistakes were made, or I could have done things better. But, he says I was rash and authoritarian. It's pretty specific, in other words, which is unusual.
Mm-hmm. He is a Jesuit. You are a Jesuit. What does that mean?
Well, a Jesuit is a Catholic religious order like the Franciscans or Benedictines or Dominicans. We take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and we live in community. In the United States, we're probably best known for educational institutions, obviously Marquette, places like that, Marquette High, and Georgetown, B.C., every college named Loyola. And we do pretty much anything that is for God's greater glory, as our slogan goes.
So does it mean that as a Pope, because he is a Jesuit, he follows certain kinds of principles, or there are certain things we can expect from him just because he is a Jesuit?
Well, that's a good question. It's a certain kind of spirituality. The spirituality is finding God in all things. But one of the hallmarks of Jesuit spirituality is freedom and what St. Ignatius, our founder, called detachment. So as you pointed out in your intro, he's free of the need to, for example, do things the way that all the popes have done in the past. So he doesn't have to live in the big apostolic palace. He doesn't have to wear the red shoes. He's kind of free of those things. And he he is, as the world is seeing, a very free man, which is kind of the goal of Jesuit spirituality.
Let's talk about money, and let's talk about what he said fairly recently, decrying the idolatry of money in secular culture, warning that it would lead to a new tyranny. Other popes have spoken of this before, but it seems to me as though he's made it front and center and spoken about it in a more dramatic way.
Well, that's an interesting question. He has made it front and center, and I think people connect him with poverty, obviously, because he took the name Francis, because he's living simply. He goes into the favelas in Rio. But in essence, he's really not saying that much different than Pope Benedict or Pope John Paul, who also talked about economic justice. I think because of who he is and because people identify him with the poor, they're, in a sense, paying attention more. But he's very strong. As you said, he's issuing a real critique of the way we do things.
And he's always had a concern for the poor.
Yeah, he has. Jesuits are concerned with, as all Christians and Catholics should be, what's called social justice, which is not only looking at the poor, but why people are poor, the systems that keep them poor. And when he was Archbishop in Buenos Aires, he had a lot of firsthand experience with the poor. So this is out of his the Gospels, obviously, first of all, but Catholic social teaching, and then more specifically his own experience as Archbishop and as a Jesuit.
I'm a little bit interested, Father Jim, in your background, because you were in the corporate world for about 6 years, I believe, before you started studying to become a Jesuit. Can you tell me about that? Did you see excesses in the corporate world? Did you leave it for any reasons of faith?
Well, I think there are excesses in any world, not just corporate America. I went to Wharton School of Business and studied finance, and then, as you said, took a job with GE. Eventually, it wasn't so much that I found GE somehow corrupt or mendacious. It was more that I realized that just wasn't the right fit for me, that business is a real vocation for a lot of people. It just didn't fit me. That's not to say that the corporate world is sinless, but it wasn't that I felt, I can no longer stand this environment. It's more that I just didn't feel that I fit in that that world.
You, in examining that speech, and we'll spend some time on this hour, you talk about what he said concerning the hierarchy of the church. The church means only thinking with the hierarchy of the church instead of thinking with the church. Why did he address that? And you described those comments as something new as far as you knew.
Yeah, it's a little bit of inside baseball for Jesuits. But basically, St. Ignatius, our founder, asked Jesuits to, quote, think with the church. Now, what does that mean? It means, it means agreeing with the church and also putting the best possible spin on what the church teaches, and to really kind of conform yourself with church teaching, which makes sense. St. Ignatius said that meant the hierarchical church, so that meant the Vatican and the bishops when they teach. Pope Francis, in a kind of new interpretation, said, along the lines of more modern, I think, contemporary theology, that thinking with the church means thinking with the church in general, not just the hierarchy, thinking with kind of more broadly the people of God, where is the Holy Spirit at work? And frankly, that I had to go back to my St. Ignatius's original line to sort of find out that he did say think with the hierarchical church. So this is a kind of reinterpretation of that old Jesuit way of doing things. And it's for me, it's very significant. It reminds people that the Holy Spirit is not just at work in the hierarchy, but in everybody, in the people of God.
So what about in the Pope? We've always heard that the Pope is infallible. Has he said anything about infallibility?
Well, no. Now the Pope is only infallible on what's called matters of faith and morals. So it's only when he says, I'm now speaking infallibly. So it's not that every word that comes out of the Pope's mouth, even on, questions of economic justice, is infallible. But no, he hasn't changed anything on that. And he has certainly not spoken infallibly on anything yet.
Let me start or go back to where I started the hour. It is absolutely amazing when you think about it. He's only been Pope since March. He's on the cover of Time. He's all over the place. He's making news every week with one statement or another. Why is he making so much news?
Well, the other thing is, you may not have seen it, but he's also the person of the year for the Advocate magazine.
I saw that today.
The Gay and Lesbian magazine, which is, that a friend of mine said, I think that means the end of the world is coming. That's just remarkable. Why is it? Well, the shorthand is people like him. People find him authentic. I think for me, the things that sort of changed people were the very first news conference he gave, he talked about, I want a church of the poor and for the poor. You know, the church that is poor and for the poor. That was a significant thing. I think the who am I to judge when it came to gay priests, and later as he made clear to gay persons in general, was a huge thing. And I also think the moving out of the Apostolic Palace and living simply really struck people, as did other symbolic actions that he's doing, for example, hugging that severely disfigured man in Vatican City and letting the little boy come up and hug him during his speech. So, you know, he speaks and he teaches as Jesus did, with not only his words but his actions as well, which really teach, I think, in a sense, more strongly than words.
And what you wrote an article about his kissing and embracing that severely disfigured man. You found the picture hard to look at, and it is, but after you look at it, it just warms your heart.
Oh,
Why was that so striking, that picture and that act?
That's a great question. For the listeners who might not know what's going on, the Pope was sort of met this man who had these, it's called neurofibromatosis, these tumors all over his face and his body. Why did it strike me? Number one, it's something that Jesus did. I mean, Jesus sort of reached out to people who in that day, you know, were called lepers. Number two, it's something St. Francis did. St. Francis of Assisi in his life embraced a leper, and legend has it that this was Christ in disguise. And, you know, and frankly, it's a, it's the way that I think God sort of reacts to us. You know, we feel, in a sense, that we are somehow scarred or disfigured in some way, obviously not externally for most of us, but internally we're sort of broken. And I think we'd like to see God as this sort of parental embrace. And then also, you know, as a priest, I just say to myself, could I do that, you know, without a moment's notice? I mean, the Pope just saw this man who I think others would recoil from. This man had said that other people, you know, when he's on the bus or something, don't want to sit next to him, who just instinctively embraced him. I thought it was incredible on so many levels. And frankly, you know, once again, stronger than pages and pages of papal teaching.
Let's take up some of the controversial issues in the church. You write about the Pope's words concerning gay people, and you say that they really haven't changed the church's teaching, but the way that the church speaks to and about gay persons, and that is new. Do you imagine, and some people in the gay community have said that he hasn't gone nearly far enough, particularly people who are concerned about the child abuse situation, which has been so horrendous all over the world, that those need to be handled by secular courts, and courts need to be hard on them, and the church needs to turn over those people to the courts. Do you imagine the Pope will say more about that particular issue? And has he and what do you mean when you say that he has changed the way the church speaks now to and about gay people?
Well, I do want to keep those issues separately, because we obviously don't want to conflate homosexuality with child abuse or pedophilia.
Right.
But I'd say, yeah, on the first question, he has changed the way the church is dealing with gays and lesbians. And that comment, who am I to judge when it comes to gay people, and also the comment that he made in our interview in America Magazine, which, by the way, is now a book. It's called A Big Heart Open to God. You know, where he said we must accompany them with mercy, is basically starting off with mercy and compassion and listening rather than condemnation. So that's a big shift in tone and in sort of focus, I would say, what you're focusing on. As for the sex abuse, he has just created a kind of a Vatican-level commission to advise them, which I think in the United States people would say, oh, big deal, he's creating a commission. But that's a big deal in the Vatican. He's kind of raising it to the level of a papal commission. So I think that's all positive. There's always more that we could do about, you know, the tragedy of sex abuse. But I think he's taking the right steps so far. And also, as you point out, he's only been in since March.
And why is it a big deal that he's creating a commission in the Vatican?
Well, because it sort of elevates it beyond something that's, you know, kind of done, you know, in one particular office. I mean, in a sense, it gives it more authority. It gives it more visibility. And, you know, I just think he also has more people advising him on how best to deal with these situations. Because, you know, you remember different countries deal with them in different ways, you know. I mean, it's always a crime and it's always a sin. But their responses have varied from country to country. So this way I think you can bring kind of best practices together to help the Pope understand it.
And some of the response, as you well know, in countries like Ireland, the response has been for a lot of Catholics to not go to church anymore. The numbers are way down. So what does this Pope do about that? And are people starting to go back to church in places like Ireland, heavily Catholic?
Yeah, Ireland I don't know about. I know other places like Italy have kind of had an explosion of people going back. I know in the United States there are people that are coming back to the church. You know, I think the thing to do about sexual abuse and clergy abuse is the same in all countries, which is, you know, number one, stop it. Number two, apologize. Number three, provide restitution for the victims. Number four, make sure it never happens again through safe environment programs. So I don't, you know, I think whether or not people are going to come back is actually less important than just kind of addressing it so it never happens again.
The other issue, of course, is women in the church. What has the Pope said about women in the church? He's talked about an expanded role. What does he mean by that? And has he changed churches' teaching on women in the church? If so, how so? And if not, what is the teaching?
Yeah, I don't think, well, I mean, you're talking about women's ordination specifically, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to change that teaching, and he said that it's not going to be changed. He has, however, talked about, and in this interview and in this book, he's talked about having really wanting women in decision-making roles in the church, you know, which is a big change. So, for example, could you have a woman that runs a Vatican congregation? There's no reason that you couldn't. You know, you don't have to be ordained to run a Vatican congregation. It's kind of an administrative role. So I think that's something that's very exciting. There was some talk about women cardinals within the past few weeks, but he kind of scotched that with an interview a few days ago where he said, which was very interesting, he said, I don't want to clericalize women. You know, he's sort of very, he's very concerned with clericalism, which is kind of, you know, sort of authority and, you know, kind of looking at priests as different kinds of people. And he said, why would I want to clericalize women? Now, you can disagree with that, but I think what he's trying to do is find creative ways of bringing women into real positions of authority and decision-making roles, which I totally support.
Let's go to phone calls momentarily. They're starting to come in, and I have a feeling we'll have many of them during the course of this hour. Father James Martin is our guest this hour, and we're talking about Pope Francis, Time Magazine's Person of the Year. And also, he was announced as the Man of the Year for Advocate, the Gay and Lesbian Magazine, which is even more interesting, perhaps. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Why has he become so talked about in such a short period of time? What are your impressions of him? And we welcome your thoughts. We have one line open at this moment. Father James Martin is a Jesuit priest. He's the culture editor of America Magazine and author of many books, including The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, and is a well-known commentator on spiritual matters. To you in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Pope Francis, that's who we're talking about this hour of the program, with Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest who has written all kinds of books, and he's a commentator on spiritual matters. He is editor-at-large of America, the National Catholic Magazine. And let's go to Danea from Viroqua, our first caller. Hi, Danea.
Hello. Excuse me for calling in with such a bad cold, but
I'm sorry.
I really want to ask a question.
Sure.
I'm so hopeful. I consider myself a recovered Catholic. I am so hopeful with these things that I'm hearing about Father Francis for the first time in a long, long time. But my question is this. Does your guest feel that the cardinals and everyone who voted him in knew him well enough to imagine that he might do these things in the first year? And if they, you know, the way that the things that he the gestures he makes and the things that he says, if they did know what they were getting, would they have still voted the same, do you think?
That's a great question. I think the short answer to that is yes and no. They knew something of what they were getting, so they knew they were getting, you know, a person who had spent a lot of time with the poor, particularly a person who would be able to reform the Curia. That was a big thing on the cardinals' minds when they came into the conclave with all the Vatty leaks, scandals, and the Vatican Bank corruption, things like that. So they knew that. They knew they were going to get someone who was decisive and could make good decisions and understood the poor. They did not know they were getting this guy. They did not know they were getting Francis the World Phenomenon, the person who would upend a lot of traditions by moving out of the Vatican and, you know, drive around in his Renault and say, who am I to judge? And they did not know that. I always tell people, though, that the Holy Spirit knew that, and the Holy Spirit, you know, knew what she was doing. So it's you know, it really shows that you can't sort of predict what God's going to do and how the Holy Spirit's going to work. It's a kind of theological thing. You know, the wind blows where it will, the Spirit blows where it will, and this is how the Spirit is blowing right now. And it's very exciting and really very hopeful time for a lot of people.
Who was the, I'm trying to remember the story this week, who was he a cardinal who got demoted or removed from some position because he was spending $45 million to renovate his residency or something like that?
That was probably about 2 months ago. It was a German bishop who had spent, yes, a lot of money to renovate his residence and was called to Rome and is now on leave. So, you know, I think, let me put it this way, as a friend of mine said, he picked a bad time to renovate his
sure
residence.
Did. Yeah, those outfits he was wearing were quite something, too.
Mm.
Yeah. Thanks, Janaea, very much for your call. We go to Bob in La Crosse. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. I was born Lutheran, and then I became Catholic when I married my wife. And then I went to the church for a while, and I became Catholic, went through RCIA. But, you know, I just still don't understand why we can't have women priests. Because I was Lutheran, and we had Lutheran lady ministers, and then I couldn't understand why the priests can't be married, because from what I understood, they were married at one time early in the church's history. So I just had those two questions.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, those are two big questions. Yeah, now, not everybody agrees with this, but the church's teaching is basically that, you know, Jesus could have chosen women for his apostles, but he did not, and so the church... Church teaching is that, therefore, the church cannot do that as well. As for priests being married, he's right. I mean, you know, if you look at someone like St. Peter was married, we know that because Jesus heals his mother-in-law. And, you know, priestly celibacy is something that could be overturned. That's more of a canonical thing. There are religious orders, though, where that would not change. So we have, like, the Jesuits. We live in community, and we take vows of chastity. But and there are married priests in the Catholic Church. We have former Episcopal priests who come over, and obviously we don't say get divorced if they're married. So that actually is something I think that you might see change. I think if there's going to be any change, I think it would be something like that. So, you know, we'll see. But currently that's the way it stands.
Kathleen is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, and I had just been going to ask the same question about priests getting married. But I attended Marquette, and I am a lifelong Catholic. And at Marquette, which is a Jesuit local institution, we were taught the concept of discernment in every single class. So people forget that 40 years ago, or plus 40 years ago, we had protest marches. Meet outside Jesuit Catholic Church almost every day at 4 o'clock, and we would be protesting against the war in Vietnam. We would be protesting in favor of Casa Maria, which is a house for abused women and social issues. And with the direction of the way the Catholic Church has been with people driving big cars and that, how do you think other people, like even Cardinal Dolan and local American cardinals will come to this? And this is just Marquette scuttlebutt, but people have been questioning, will he be murdered? Is he safe?
Oh, my gosh.
And that's heresy, I know, to say that. But because his ideas seem so radical to so many people, and people like his ideas, but that he's just a target.
Well, yeah, I mean, God forbid. But I mean, I want to separate your questions because, you know, you don't want to suggest, obviously, and you're not, that the Cardinals are going to have him murdered because they don't agree with him. I know that's not what you're saying. But, yeah, I would say, you know, it is definitely a different focus, as you were saying before, that there was more of an emphasis, I would say, at the hierarchical level 40 years ago on questions of social justice. Not to say that there hasn't been, but he really is putting it front and center. I don't think anyone can deny that. How the Cardinals are responding, I think a lot of them are sort of surprised, as our earlier caller said, and you know, Cardinal Dolan in New York said, you know, I'm really learning from this guy. You know, I'm learning about, you know, the way to sort of a new way of being church, which I think is really important. There is a lot of resistance in the Vatican, and, you know, he's shaking things up. But, you know, there's resistance in any organization. There was resistance in GE when things were changed, so that's not too surprising. And as I always tell people who are worried about his safety, he survived in Argentina, you know, during the war. So I think, and he's a pretty smart Jesuit, so I don't worry about him too much. But I do pray for his health every day.
Do you see shades of Vatican II in this Pope and what he's will be accomplishing?
Oh, I see more than shades. I see a Pope who is deeply influenced by the Second Vatican Council, particularly in that idea of the Holy Spirit working through the people of God, and then also something that's a kind of another inside baseball term, collegiality. So the not just having the Pope sort of direct every bishop, but saying that, you know, bishops and local pastors and people on the ground, you know, should be able to make decisions for themselves and to sort of see the church as kind of the whole people and not just the top down. So absolutely, I see him as a very Vatican II Pope. But by the same token, as a friend of mine liked to point out to me the other day, he's not just a Vatican II Pope. He's a Pope for 2013 and 2014. You know, things have even changed in the last 50 years.
Thanks, Kathleen, very much for your call. A couple of Facebook messages. Ellen on Facebook writes, I have never stopped appreciating the Jesuits. Go Frankie the Pope. John on Facebook writes, a pretty good guy, but too late with too little. He'll do much to decorrupt the church, but how could the one true faith have gotten corrupt in the first place? The scholarly approach to education is still something I cherish. We took Latin, read Shakespeare in high school. Because of the religious element, priests and nuns, by and large, really cared about everyone's well-being, supportive of the civil rights movement, something average Catholics resisted. Around the time the Beatles went to India, I started looking east, and I haven't stopped.
Yeah, you know, one thing I would say about the church being corrupt, you know, the church has been sinful since day one. I mean, you know, the first person to lead the church was St. Peter, who denied Jesus three times. So it's always been a place, you know, of saints and sinners. And I think sort of looking back on church history, you get a little better view of the church, and you don't. I think we tend to say this is the worst time for the church because it's so corrupt. But you know, it has survived all these years thanks to the Spirit.
Let's go next to Joan in Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an old lady. I'm 81, and I've run out of patience, except for I think the Spirit of Franciscanism and Saint Francis, yeah, Francis our Pope, and hopefully the Holy Spirit. I have hope, and you know what? I'm going to step over the line into the side of the prophetic and the women who have spoken and been. The church tried to ignore them. Their own religious orders tried to ignore them. But the women who have seen through a lot of things that men might have missed, the mystic women. And I treasure the idea that someday, after I'm gone, maybe, but someday, the fact that I have a belly button and Jesus had a belly button, make us equal in the eyes of Mother, Father, God.
Father Jim.
Well, I think that's beautiful. I think she's right. You know, the women, I think, are always doing it first. I think, you know, for example, women religious in the United States, I think, who have been kind of caricatured and, you know, treated as sort of silly, and, you know, nuns are kind of silly and stupid, and people make fun of them on TV and in movies. I mean, these are the women that you know, that built schools, that built hospitals, that, you know, kind of carved out the American Catholic Church in the Midwest and in the West. And I think we owe them a great debt. And I think they are. I think they're totally underappreciated. You have someone like St. Theodore Guérin, Mother Guérin, from Indiana, who comes over from France and is told by her bishop to resign from the congregation she founded. And, you know, she kind of stuck with it. And the bishop's removed, and now she's a saint. So, I mean, I always think of, when I think of women religious and women in the church, I think of the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers thing, you know. that she did exactly what Fred Astaire did, except backwards in high heels.
Right.
So I think the church has seriously underestimated and undervalued the contribution of women. So I agree with the caller.
Thanks, Joan, very much for the call. Kyle on Facebook writes, I'm an atheist, and even I am impressed by this pope, which makes me wonder about the pope's rule beyond Catholicism, beyond Catholics, because he's drawn the attention of people of all faiths and atheists. What role does a pope play in addressing issues that he would like the whole world community to take on? And has this pope been able to convey any of those kinds of messages that have been accepted by the world community of all faiths or no faith?
I think definitely. Well, first of all, in terms of atheists, I hear that from a lot of my atheist and agnostic friends. And the Pope has said, you know, we treat atheists like our brothers. They are our brothers, right? And he even talked about, I think he said, proselytism, which is trying to sort of forcibly, convert someone, is, quote, pious nonsense, which is pretty strong. So, you know, he leads by invitation and by example. You know, and as for sort of setting the tone for the rest of the world, I think his comments, particularly on the economy, have really sparked a conversation. I think, you know, I speak as a Wharton grad and a finance major. You know, I think he is providing a much-needed critique of capitalism, which I think is the most efficient system sort of to deliver goods and services. It's not perfect. And what he's saying is it's not perfect, and we have to look especially at the poor. And I think that's really been listened to by people across the world.
Let's go next to Susan in Menominee Falls. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I have been listening and heard you refer to your friend a couple times. One comment was that your friend said, oh, my God, the world is going to end. And that was in relation to the Pope's somewhat conciliatory stance on gay and lesbians. That I would like to hear about. And then secondly, if this pope is social justice, why aren't these priests that have committed these sins with children not in jail? And
what?
I guess, too, excuse me, that I think this friend thing, you made some very flippant comments, and I apologize if that's incorrect. Thank you.
All right, Susan.
Okay, well, number one, the friend said, oh, my gosh, that, you know, he's on the cover of The Advocate that was kind of a compliment, basically. It was a joke for my friend saying that he is surprised that the Pope is on the cover of The Advocate. So that was what my friend was saying. As for priests being in jail who committed the crimes, they are. And, you know, the priests who have committed sexual abuse and have done anything criminal are in jail like anybody else is. Anyone who is found sort of having a credible accusation against him, like the Archbishop of Minneapolis 2 days ago, is immediately removed from ministry. So that's happening, basically. And I think that's as a result of what the U.S. bishops have done in 2002. Now, the question is, I think, moving ahead, you know, how do we prevent that from happening again? I think that, to me, that's the more salient question. But, you know, you look at Archbishop Nienstedt from Minneapolis, who, you know, even as an archbishop, there's this credible accusation. He's out, you know, until it's being investigated. So that's what's going on there.
Can you make a statement, though, that is large that all of these priests are in jail?
I can't say everybody. I mean, no more than I can say every person who abuses someone in a school or in a family is in jail. But I would say that, you know, all the accusations that are credible mean that the person is removed from ministry, and if there's a crime, he's treated like anybody else, is what I'm saying. So just as much as that happens in schools or in families or in hospitals or in any sort of youth care, you know, it's happening in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, what the church is trying to do is trying to kind of take the lead. They're trying to be they're trying to put in so many kind of safe environment programs and safe practices and kind of reporting requirements that they're actually trying. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is trying to be kind of the sort of avatar, you know, for you, how you handle this. So that's their goal.
Let's talk a little bit more about his comments concerning the economy, because these are undoubtedly going to be brought up in political campaigns in the United States, the presidential campaign, but also midterm elections. He said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories, which assume that economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system. Those are pretty strong words.
They're very strong. And I think one of the things that's interesting is when you talk about it in terms of politics, you know, I would say some Catholic politicians who say, you know, I'm completely in line with the Pope are going to have to sort of reexamine things. And the question is whether or not the same Catholic politicians, you know, I don't want to name names or name parties, but the same Catholic politicians who say, you must support this because this is what the Catholic Church teaches, are now going to have to grapple with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is really strong. These are strong words coming from the Pope, and I agree with him. I mean, trickle-down economics, you know, as far as I can see, you know, has not worked. There are still poor people on our streets, and that's what he's pointing to. He's talking about, you know, just the reality of the situation and saying that, you know, this rising tide that was supposed to lift all the boats has still, I mean, you know, to continue the metaphor, left some people in the mud. And it is our responsibility to kind of to care for these people and also to look at the systems that have led to that. So that's a very good question. What will politicians who have traditionally relied on, the argument that the church teaches this and therefore this is what you must believe, what are they going to say? We'll see.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Pope Francis this hour of the program. Time Man of the Year and also Person of the Year for Advocate, the Gay and Lesbian magazine. Taking this all in and analyzing everything for us is Father James Martin, who has looked very carefully at what the Pope has had to say in a variety of issues. He is a culture editor of America magazine. He's the author of all kinds of books, including The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. And he's a commentator. You probably have seen him before on The Colbert Report. He's been on Terry Gross, The O'Reilly Factor. Also has written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, BBC, and he's our guest this hour as we talk about the Pope and what the big deal is, why he's everywhere. 8 months in his position, he's everywhere. What is it about him that has so captured our attention? 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Also, our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We have all kinds of things there. Daniel Golden was with us a couple days ago, and he has compiled this huge book list. So in case you're doing any kind of gift shopping or want recommendations for what to read for the next year and you're not quite caught up on this year's reading, there are lots of suggestions. Our favorite books of the year are also there. So we'd like to get, KP has this goal to get 5,000 listeners by the end of the year. I think it's, I told him, wildly optimistic. But, you know, we can get 4,000. We're very close to that right now. Sharing our page with your friends, they can join the conversation that's on Facebook and get recommendations and read articles that we're talking about. And it's good. It's a good thing to do. So use that for comments. We use them on the air as well. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Rick is next in Lake Geneva. Hello, Rick.
Good day to you. Real quick question. You know, growing up in Milwaukee, you know, the name was Father James Grappi. Mm-hmm. You know, my question is, was Father James Grappi one of these pre-revolutionary type of people like the Pope is today? You know, his love for humanity, his outlook for the different race, you know, his empathy for, you know, for the poor. You know, was he somewhat of a pre-revolutionary? And I'll let the Father answer that, and I'll get off the phone and listen on the radio.
All right, Rick.
I unfortunately don't know the priest he's talking about. But
Father James Grappi
is he
from Milwaukee?
Is he well known there, or?
Yeah, he was very involved in the civil rights movement, in desegregation movement in the city of Milwaukee. A prominent figure during that time period, 1960s.
Okay, you know, I would say this, that there have always been priests and sisters, and obviously lay people like that. And I think that they may not have been in our sort of public consciousness as much as they were maybe like 40 or 50 years ago. But, you know, there are people that have been working for social justice kind of in the trenches, you know, in the Catholic Church, priests and sisters and brothers, women and men religious, for years. And I think what's going on is that, you know, as he's doing with the Catholic social teaching, I think the Pope is kind of focusing a lens on that or highlighting it more so that we're more aware of those kinds of people now and more aware of those kinds of roles. I mean, you know, I worked in the 1990s in East Africa with refugees, with the Jesuit Refugee Service. That kind of work, Catholic Relief Service, Catholic Charities, it's been going on the whole time. You know, it's just that we may not have been as aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about this interview with the Pope. The dogmatic and moral teaching of the Church are not equivalent. Can you discuss what he says about this and what he says about the hierarchy of truths?
Yeah, that's a great question. We Catholics, even sort of educated Catholics, sometimes tend to think that every word out of the Pope's mouth or every word out of a bishop's mouth or every word out of a cardinal's mouth is infallible or it has to be taken with the same degree of seriousness, you know, as any other teaching. And there is, in Catholic theology, what's called a hierarchy of truths. So the simplest example is this. The teaching about and our belief about the resurrection, that Christ rose from the dead, you know, and the Trinity, those kinds of things, is simply not on the same level as what your local parish priest says about, you know, some local matter. You know, people would say, well, of course that makes sense. I don't have to, if my priest says that, you know, I don't like this particular movie, you wouldn't say that it's kind of holy writ, and you wouldn't put it on the same level as like the Trinity or the resurrection. But I think we tend to forget those things, and for whatever reason, Catholics feel that, or Catholics have been led to believe, I think, that every word out of a church leader's mouth is close to infallible, and that is simply not accurate. It's not Catholic theology, and what's going on in that interview is the Pope is reminding us of that. He's saying we need to put things in perspective, basically, which I think is really healthy. We need to remember that.
Hunter in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think the economic statements that he's been making are incredible and very inspiring. I'm wondering why, though, is everybody, Protestants, Catholics, you know, atheists alike, so surprised about these statements, given the teachings and life of Christ, who, you know, was born into poverty and live that life and taught from that platform. Thanks.
Thank you, Hunter.
That's a great question. Yeah, that is the question. Rush Limbaugh recently said that the Pope is a Marxist. And, you know, obviously, I would say Mr. Limbaugh has not been paying attention as closely to Catholic social teaching as he should have, which is a kind of understatement. And, yeah, it's in the Gospels. I mean, Jesus says the litmus test for entrance into heaven is how we treat the least of our brothers and sisters. He talks about poverty constantly. He's born into a poor family. He reaches out to the poor. So I think, though, that there have been places in the Catholic Church that have not stressed that as much. You know, there have been other issues that have come to the fore. You know, issues that the Pope mentions in our interview, abortion, birth control, gay marriage, that seem to be on people's lips more. And he's basically reminding us that, you know, there are other issues, and I think he's trying to balance things out a little bit. So I think that's a very good question.
Let's talk a little bit more about this, and I think we've covered it earlier when we looked at his embrace of people who are disfigured, his washing feet of prisoners, et cetera. And you talk about, when you looked at that interview, the most moving part of the entire interview was when he discussed finding God in every human being.
Yeah, he has this great sort of description of why we can't be sort of dogmatic and just sort of, you know, kind of reduce things to just kind of propositions. And we need to have some uncertainty in our lives. And we deal with God, which is true. We have to have uncertainty. We can never completely understand God. So he says, you know, we need to have room for uncertainty. And then he says, here's my certainty, : God can be found in every person, period. I just found it very clarifying and moving, and it's also very Jesuit. There's this idea of finding God in all things and in all people, and I think that's a beautiful place to start. God can be found in every person, which means that you respect every person as a child of God, you know, black and white, gay and straight, rich and poor, every woman and man, every person is an image of God. And it was just, I guess what I liked about it and what I found so moving, it was just so clear and so simple and also so accessible to people. I mean, people really kind of can grab onto that and understand it.
Tom in Mayville. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Father. I'm reading your Jesuit guidebook for Advent. It's wonderful. Thanks.
Oh, good. You're welcome. Hope you enjoy it.
Say, I have a question about religious persecution. The Pope had given one of those daily mass homilies, and he was talking about the Gospel of Luke and the end times, and he was talking about the increasing persecution of Christians around the world, and he said if it really gets bad to the point where worship is prohibited, then he said, almost sounded like Billy Graham, he said, then Jesus is going to come back. I was wondering if you were aware of him being interested in that issue of religious persecution around the world and if we're likely to hear more of that.
Well, that's a very good question. And I would also recommend his daily homilies are just very inviting and sort of accessible. Yeah, he is very aware of that. There is a religious persecution kind of on the rise of Christians. I think we have to keep it in perspective. You know, there are places where Christians are really persecuted, where they are prevented from saying Mass, where they're killed. You know, that's different than, you know, I would say some of the opposition that religious leaders face in this country, so we have to distinguish that. He's very much aware of that. I wasn't aware of that comment about Jesus coming back. I don't know if he would have, if he means that, you know, obviously he thinks Jesus is about to come back, because he himself says we have to be, you know, we can't be certain about these things. So it may have been more of a figure of speech, I'm thinking, but I don't want to speak for the Pope.
Well, it would certainly be the news story of 2014.
Yes, it would. It would. Then Jesus would be the man of the year on time.
Yes, he probably would be.
You know, if Miley Cyrus doesn't beat him out.
Exactly. Oh, heaven help us all. Thank you, Tom, very much for your call. Dan in Baraboo is next. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Father. Your justification for why women aren't ordained is, quite frankly, pious nonsense. There's no basis in history whatsoever for that. And anyway, that's just the way it is. And by the way, one of my best friends is a Jesuit.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Well, one of my best friends is a Jesuit, too. I would say this. Here's the strongest argument for women being ordained, which is that they feel called. That's probably the strongest argument that people, women, say to me, I feel called to be a priest, right? So that's the strongest argument, I think, for their inclusion, and also that it works in other denominations. But it is true, I mean, that, you know, however you slice it, that Christ, you know, chose 12 men, and he did that in an environment where he was, you know, had women in his inner circle of disciples like Mary Magdalene, other strong women. That argument may not convince people, but that's the church's argument, that's what they rested on. So I don't know if it's nonsense, because that really is accurate, that Christ chose 12 men as apostles. Whether or not it's convincing is another story.
So if you were going to change that, how do you go about doing that in the Catholic Church?
I certainly wouldn't be doing it. You mean, how would the Pope change that?
Would it be up to the Pope to change that?
Yeah, I mean, something like that. And once again, he has said that's not going to change. I think that the more interesting question, because it's in the realm of possibility, is married clergy. And also perhaps the possibility of women deacons. That's another possibility that's coming up that we haven't talked about. How would he change married clergy? I think he could probably do it with a stroke of a pen.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's more of a juridical thing that priests aren't allowed to marry. But, you know, he has not given any indication that he's going to do that. So I also, once again, he's only been, as you say, 8 months. So, you know, give the guy a break.
Well, he may have a long time to go, right?
We hope so. Someone in Rome told me that, to the earlier caller who asked, you know, did they know what they were getting? I've heard this from two people in Rome, that the cardinals knew that they wanted someone who could change things quickly, which is interesting. Because of the sort of problems in the Vatican Curia, the headquarters, they wanted someone who could act quickly, and that they got.
They sure did.
They really did.
And then some. Father James Martin, thank you so much for being with us. It was an interesting. The audience was good today.
They
had
were
a
great.
Lot of Catholics. Yeah.
Well, I figured that, you know, in Wisconsin, you got some very educated people. So
we do.
I knew they'd be good questions. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Father James Martin, our guest this hour. He is a Jesuit priest. He is the culture editor of America Magazine, and it's worth going to their website, because he's done some analysis of the Pope's major interview, which is very interesting. And Father Martin is also quite a prolific author of The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything and a number of other books, and is frequently seen on television and heard on the radio. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour, and to Judith Sears-Poissant, actually, as well. And thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. We'll be back after the news.